The machine is on. Good. So it's recording. So welcome everybody to today's talk, and we're going to start off with pineapples. It's marvellous, isn't it? You don't have to even tell the punchline and people are already laughing. You're worse than I am. Okay, it's a nice place to start, because sometimes you can be really serious and sometimes that you can get very deep. But it's also on a retreat like this, it's nice to also remember how to just have some peace and quiet sometimes, and how to laugh sometimes, and how we balance this in our meditation. And, you know, even the Buddha made jokes, believe it or not, and one of the ones I remember was that he was walking with Ananda, and he walked past some of the Jain community in India at the time, and those Jain community were doing very harsh ascetic practices, you know, standing on one leg all day and just facing the sun and hardly eating at all. And, you know, it was obviously very ascetic. And then I think Ananda, or they had a conversation, the Buddha and Ananda, and was saying, why do they do this stuff? And I think Ananda said, well, they have the idea that if you can burn off all your past karma, especially burn off all your bad karma from the past, and once you're free of that bad karma, then you'll have lots of good energy and happiness and joy, and you can become enlightened. And then I think the Buddha said something like, well, it just shows you just how much bad karma those Jains had to do in the past, because look at us, you know, we don't have to do this, we still get enlightened. Or something like that. You're nice and warm. It was obviously looking at it in a funny way, not trying to be serious. You can't say that people have done lots and lots and lots and lots of bad karma, therefore they have to do that. It's one of the reasons why I've often told you that all the bad karma you have done, you don't need to wipe it all out, you know, one by one. It is very much like the karma you've done in two separate bank accounts. And the two separate bank accounts are good karma bank account and the bad karma bank account. Totally different. And so what you can do, doesn't matter how much you try and wear out, pay off your bad karma, it's impossible. You've done too much. Because the way the Buddha described it, it was, you know, maybe you just read it, say, oh yes, but don't really contemplate it deeply. If you did just do one bad act of karma, a tiny bad act of karma, and then that's multiplied many times after you've done that small bad act of karma. It's not just you do it once and you have to receive it back once. You get that many times back. You know, you sort of hurt your mum or your dad, or you hurt, say, a monk or a nun. Then it's only a small thing, but then afterwards it can keep multiplying so many times. You think, ah! But then you don't have to worry, you're all forgiven many times over, so your bank account has been wiped out. Your bad bank account towards what you've done to me, what you've done to the nuns, it's all been wiped out, hasn't it, ladies? Yes, okay. But the good bank account is the same. They used to, there's suttas in there. You know the highest gift of dana you could ever do once a Buddha's passed away? Once a Buddha's passed away, the biggest donation you can do, you get the most bang for bucks, is an offering to the monks and the nuns together. I always mention that. That's the top. And I mention that because in some countries you don't have that opportunity. They don't allow bhikkhunis. And there it is, it says that's a high. So you're very fortunate here in Perth. I reckon because many of you have given so many good donations to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis here in Perth. That's one of the reasons why we don't have COVID. Well, I don't know, that's what the Buddha said. But anyway, so just one good act of karma, one good act, is you get thousands back in return. So obviously you've all done huge amounts of good karma, So you've got a huge bank account of good karma there. You've also got a huge amount of bad karma as well. Both are almost inexhaustible. So why is it? Why is it that bad karma comes up for some? Why is it that good karma comes up for some? And the point is that you do have heaps and heaps of good karma, but you've forgotten your PIN number. So it's hard to access sometimes. And I'll tell you what the PIN number is. It's very easy. It's reflecting on all the good things you've done. It's a positive mind state. And that's one of the reasons why that one of our meditations, people don't understand this. They think, I just want to go to the deep meditations, you know, breath and nimitta and stuff like that. Let's get right into it. You can't wait to get enlightened. But one of the great meditations is things like chaganusati, which is the recollection of all your kindness and generosity. Your silanusati, your precepts, and what precepts actually do for you in this world. And you also, you've got recollections of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. All those reflections, by literally when you're in your room or having a breakfast or having a cup of tea or whatever, you're sitting out there, remember all the kindness and goodness you've done in your life. Remember that and allow it to just to really come into you. And then you start to tie in, key in to the good karma account you've had. And all these wonderful, happy, lucky things occur to you and happen to you. That's basically how you... So what I do, that sometimes, that you know, I'm old and I work hard, and sometimes you get tired. And there's been a few times in my life I've been really tired. Oh my goodness, I've got to give another talk this evening. I've got to give another lecture this evening. Oh, what am I going to do? I'm so exhausted. But don't worry about it, because I know how to just to get this excess good energy. And I remember one time which I did that. I hope the Singaporeans are listening, or it's recorded, they can listen to it later. But they wanted to bring the Buddhism a little bit closer to people's lives in Singapore. So they wrote this little play. And the play about, you know, keep it sort of honest to life, about a person who got married, and then they had a lot of difficulty after they got married. And then eventually what solved all the problems after they got married was that someone gave them a book by Ajahn Brahm. And when they said that, it was really kitsch, but I didn't mind. I didn't write it. And after I was mentioned, then I had to walk onto the stage. And when I walked onto the stage and I sat down and gave a little talk. Okay, that was the plot, if you like. But I didn't mind doing that, try that, see what happens. And then anyway, after giving my presentation, and then it was all finished and everybody left, that was the afternoon show. But they're going to have another performance in the evening, same thing. And I just arrived from Perth on the morning flight. You got there just about midday, and then just straight to that theatre to do that performance. And then everybody else, they went off to the restaurant. Well, I can't go to the restaurant. And of course they started getting sort of energized going to the restaurant. So they asked me, well, what would you want to do? And I knew, so in that theatre there was one of the, I don't know, they shouldn't have done this, there was one of the fire exits which was blocked. So I said, great, I'm going to go down there. And it was nice and quiet, like a little cave. I had about an hour, so I could meditate. And that was great, doing stuff like that, because I was tired, I needed a big boost of energy. There was no tea or coffee or anything like that there. So I just sat there, and of course when you sit when you're really tired, your head is down. It was natural. I'd just been really busy travelling all morning. And to travel to get to the airport on time, I had to get up about 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning and travel and And when you get there, so we have to, check in and stuff. This was a few years ago. It's probably even more complicated now. But anyway, I've been just busy all the time. And as soon as after the talk, I was really tired. But I have enough understanding now how the body and mind works just to let it slump. Fighting it would just be wasting the little energy which I had. So I let it slump. And I was just peaceful. What do you focus on? Whatever's right in front of you right now, which was tiredness, low energy. I'm still aware, but just didn't even bother trying to straighten myself up. The most important object is right in front of you. The thing at the time which is most important is right now. And the most important thing to do was to care. That's what I did. I was caring for my body and mind. And it only takes about 5 or 10 minutes. And then you get energy. The body straightens up. And as I mentioned yesterday, it straightens up all by itself. I never told it what to do and when to do it. It just straightens up. And once it straightens up, it's a sign the energy is coming back. And just after even half an hour, 45 minutes, I was buzzing. And then after an hour, I was full of energy, ready to go. And I've used that so many times to get into that good bank account, positivity, peace, and all the great energies and stuff come up. And great ideas come up too. So anyway, that good karma account, which you have, is there. Please make use of it. And sometimes people make bad karma, and I don't know why they do this, but this was a time, some years ago, that they had this idea, in Thailand, that whatever you offer to monks or nuns, once you've offered it, and you resolve that this, I dedicate the merits of this, say, to my father or grandfather who's passed away, and they will get that. So if you offer them a piece of durian, offer the monks a piece of durian, that's what your mum will get in heaven. And I remember learning about that because once somebody offered me a piece of durian, I said I don't fancy any durian today, so I passed it down the line. Oh, the donor was so upset. What? He didn't accept my durian? That means my mother won't be able to get any durian in heaven this week. That's what she thought. But that wasn't the worst of it. The worst of it was a couple of years later, when those of you who go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, that sometimes people do what they call Sanghadana. And this particular time, they had a whole like buckets with lots of different, like toothpaste and toothbrushes and soap and other little bits and pieces, all in the bucket all together. Just maybe some tea, maybe some coffee. I don't know what was in there. You just accept it because there's lots of people waiting, and the anagarikas, they take it down to the kitchen where they have their lunch first of all, then they open it up and see what's in there, and so they can stack it in all the different places. And then I just accepted so many of these in my life. I just accept it, give the blessing, pass it down. But this time, the anagarikas brought up the bucket afterwards with a big smile on their face, a cheeky smile on their face. What's up? And they announced, Ajahn Brahm, do you know what you've just received? It was a Sanghadana. Do you know what was in the middle of that bucket? No, what? It was a full bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey. I'm not allowed to accept anything like that. It was hidden inside. They'd gone to a lot of trouble to hide it so I couldn't see it. I had all the soap on the outside and dishwashing liquid and other stuff on the outside so you couldn't actually see what's right down the bottom. They tried to do that so that their father, who liked whiskey, apparently could get some whiskey up in heaven. And that's what I told you. You don't need to do that. All you need to do is to give a donation, we'll collect the amount, and we'll transfer the credit up to heaven. They can buy their own whatever they want up there. I was only joking to them. But anyway, just the idea of good karma. And when people make a mistake, well, they did it on purpose. It was me who made a mistake by not checking enough. When you make a mistake like that, what do? No. Tell everybody. So you can share the laughter as well. But then afterwards, I don't know how much whiskey costs these days, but it's quite expensive stuff. So the Anagarikas asked, well, what should we do with this now? And I went down to the kitchen to make sure, pour it down the sink. Do we have to? Yes. So I had to watch them pour all the whiskey down the sink. So it was all gone. And anyway. This is another one for you. I'll get on to the pineapple in a moment. Because in this case, you know, I already mentioned we go on pilgrimage very often. I used to when I was younger. Go pilgrimage over to India to see the holy sites. And we were going to the town of Lumbini, just in southern Nepal. That's where the Buddha was born. And it's really inspiring. I really get into this inspiration stuff. And because I've been a Buddhist for such a long time, when you go to these places, sometimes you allow it to really move you and create these beautiful emotions of peace and happiness and joy. You remember all the stories about things which went on there, and they're beautiful stories. And I'll do the tangent first of all, because one of the stories I remembered, which I remember telling to people, when we were just going to the town of Patna, and that was before it was called Pataliputra, and that was where Asoka had his big palace and where his capital. And anyway, one of the great stories I remember there from that time, that Asoka had a brother, and like, if you're the emperor, you're the boss, sometimes your younger brother always has a bit of jealousy. Now why can't I be emperor too, or why can't I be the boss? And it was well known that the emperor's brother was also just wanted, you know, all that power and authority and all the pleasures which come from being an emperor. And Asoka knew that. And Asoka was a good Buddhist. How can I teach my brother a good lesson in Dhamma? So, Asoka, he was going for his bath. He went inside the bath chamber. And of course, he had to take all the royal insignia off when he went inside the bath chamber. And he arranged it without his brother realizing it, that his brother was just walking past and saw all of the emperor's regalia and jewelry and crowns, whatever they wore in those days, and a couple of his attendants said, "Oh, look, your brother, you know, the emperor, he's left all his gear outside." So, "Oh yeah, that's a bit dangerous," said the brother. And the attendant said, "Well, no, he's not going to be out for a while. Why don't you just try it on, just to see?" "Oh, I can't do that, that's illegal." "Oh, no one will know, we won't tell." And so, you know, he put on all the royal regalia, all the robes and whatever the emperor had. And just when he just put the last little piece on, the emperor came out. It was just a setup. But the brother didn't know that. And the emperor said, "Younger brother, what are you doing? You're wearing the emperor's robes and you're not the emperor. I was just trying them on, you never know one day. I didn't mean anything by it." And the emperor said, "You know the penalty for that, don't you? Wearing the royal robes when you're not the royal, the emperor." "Oh yeah, but it was only just for temporarily." He said, "Well, I am the emperor. I've got to administer the law evenly, no matter to whom. You're obviously wearing the robes. You're guilty. You know what the punishment is." And he said, "Oh no, please don't." He said, "I have to be fair to everybody. The punishment is you have to be executed." And he fell on the floor and he begged forgiveness from the emperor. He said, "If I forgive you, that will be a sign of corruption." He said, "It hurts me, but you'll have to be executed." "Oh, please, please." And he said, well, you are my brother. So what I will do, I'll just give you a stay of execution for 1 week. 7 days from now, you have to be executed. In the meantime, because you wanted to be emperor so much, you can enjoy all the robes and the food and everything else, all the pleasures of being an emperor, but you can't make any decisions. Otherwise you might execute me and I won't be able to execute you back. But I'll give you 1 week of being the emperor. You wanted it so much. But afterwards I have to administer justice. And so the emperor went away. And the emperor's brother had all the pleasures, the joys of food and dancing and stuff, which every emperor gets. And at the end of those 7 days, the emperor sort of came back after his little holiday. And the emperor said to his brother, he said, well, now is the time I've got to keep my word as well. You have to be executed, but before I execute you, how did you feel being emperor for 1 week? Did you enjoy it? Did you have fun? And that's when the young man said, have fun, enjoy it, when you know you're going to die in a few days. It was hell. I didn't even sleep well at night. I couldn't eat properly. I was so tense and stressed out, looking at the minutes go past closer to my execution. And at that, the emperor smiled and said, okay, I've forgiven you. The execution is now cancelled. You can go free. I just did this just so that you can realize that sensory pleasures, how much they're worth. When it comes to, you know, you're going to die soon, who wants to enjoy themselves? Who wants to actually just to have the greatest food or the greatest music, the softest beds? It was a little lesson for you, my little brother. I don't hate you, I won't kill you. You're my brother. But nevertheless, this was how I would teach you some Dhamma. And of course, he got it. Just all that wanting for sensory pleasures, for so-called safety, for enjoyment, when the death is lurking around the corner, you can't enjoy it anymore. Anyway, I remember that story, and it was a bit of fun. To telling people on the long, bumpy, dusty, dirty roads going through India to the the holy places. But anyway, back to the pumpkin. Oh no. And then we go to the pineapple afterwards. Because on this one occasion that was in Lumbini, and it was a full moon day tomorrow. And the full moon day over there, we've got a job, we have to do the Patimokkha chanting. And there were four monks there, including myself, so we had to do the Patimokkha chanting. I knew how to do the chant the Patimokkha, even though I hadn't done it for a while. So in Lumbini, around one of the big Bodhi trees there, the four of us sat down there and I started chanting the Patimokkha. It takes about 45 minutes of Pali chanting. I was really going for it, you know, closed eyes, really focusing. And when I finished, I found right in front of me there was a few rupees, a rupee note there. And there was also some weeds there. And when the other monks, they were looking at me, smiling really widely. I said, what happened? I said, well, while you were chanting, you're focusing on the chant. There was this Indian lady, and she saw you, and she was really impressed with how much you can focus and keep on chanting like that in Pali. And she was really impressed with your samadhi. So what she did, she bowed three times, and then she put some donations in there of rupees. I said, why'd you put the weeds there? She said, that's not any weed, that is the weed. Ganja. They'd offer me some marijuana. I didn't know what it was, but apparently that's common over there. They probably thought I was going a bit crazy chanting like that, and they thought that's probably what I'm used to. I said, no, 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 no. And again, it was a case, what are you going to do with it, Ajahn Brahm? And just busted off. And then, you guys, I'm watching you. They never took any, they were good monks. But it's strange what people offer to monks. It's, they come from a good heart, but those are the things, obviously, we should never accept. No monks. But anyway, the pineapple. So is it okay to accept a pineapple? Depends what you use it for, isn't it? You asked for this one. So anyway, first year with Ajahn Chah, people don't realize just how poor that monastery was in the first year. It was only just that one monastery, no other. Oh, there was another monastery outside of Ubon, which was one of his monks. But then, if you needed anything, there's only about 20 monks, 30 monks there. And if you needed anything, you just go and ask Ajahn Chah, you know, you need some flashlights, or you do need some batteries, or you need some... At this particular time, I needed some soap. And you don't keep a store of it, you just go there and just ask, any soap? And then he had a big, like, water jar, and you just fish in there and see if there's anything there, and you've got some soap. He gave it to you. And that's actually how we shared all of our requisites, especially when he was very poor. And so this one day, but of course Ajahn Chah did not understand English. It was only later on he learned the one word of English, cup of tea. So this particular time I had to learn Thai, a Lashan. What's the Thai word for soap? It's what? The soap. Thai. Sabu, yeah. So I went there, Sabu, 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 Sabu. And I asked Ajahn Chah for some sapo. It's only a little bit different, that's all. Sapo says sapo. I just asked, sapo? What do you want sapo for? He was very kind. And I said, to wash. We use it for washing. And someone like Ajahn Chah looks and then he realizes what's going on and he just laughs his head off. And he used that for days to keep himself happy. Every person who visited from town, he kept on saying that, you know, these people in England, they're very advanced, you know, much more advanced. So we use soap when we wash, they use pineapple when they wash. Far more natural. And he will let me forget that. The monk who washed with pineapple. And of course, the main thing I learned there, I learned two things from that. I learned that whenever you do make a mistake, just laugh. And everybody joins in the fun. It just shows that none of us are perfect, that we all make mistakes. And when we do, don't be proud or arrogant or think that, oh, they should know better, they should laugh at me. Everybody joins in the fun with for mistakes. And when that happens, the other thing I learned was how to pronounce sabu. I know the difference between soap and pineapple. Okay? Yeah, now the talk. Oops. It's half an hour gone already. It's great to have some fun and joy. And it's great to be able to get that energy inside of yourselves. And to the point that hopefully the morning talk, you actually look forward to it. You want to come. And the mind, because it wants to come, it starts to look forward to it. And the mind engages much easily with the talk. If it's something you come, you've got to come. Oh, here we go again. Another half an hour to go. Oh my goodness. Am I going to last? But these days, it's very easy. If you don't like the talks, it's very easy to endure. Because all you need to do is just to get some of those headphones over there and just tune it up to another channel. No, you can't do things like that. But you know, a few times that I got very bored, because when Ajahn Chah started talking, you couldn't go out and you can't stop. You just sat there. So I had this great idea once. I was very innovative. Because over there in Thailand, the villagers used to use these slingshots. It's a piece of wood and a fork and a rubber band, and they could pull the rubber band back and strike it. They did that to scare off like animals. And I thought, that sounds really good. Because to end the talk, they'd always just, you know, ring a gong. And I was a pretty good shot. You could be sitting over there in the back, or over there. Bing! The talk is over. But I remember thinking about that. Because sometimes you're a human being, you're getting really tired and just not really understanding it. But then, instead of doing stuff like that, you learned a little bit of endurance, and you also learned just that we have this wonderful sense of gratitude as well. Ajahn Chah was trying his best to actually talk in a way that would help people. And if the Dhamma talk is always just like the food you have here all over Bodhinyana. It's a buffet. There's no way in the world you can eat everything, but hopefully there's enough good food there for you. You can make a meal of, you know, what's presented there. There's enough good Dhamma which is presented, you know, with talks, Q&A, sutta class and other stuff, that there's enough there for you to get some answers to some of the deep problems. And not just the answers in words, but the answers in feelings, in emotions, so your emotions can actually grow and the blockages can disappear. You don't have to understand and accept everything. What works for you? Accept that. And let the mind grow and get more and more peaceful, more and more happy, more and more powerful. And what you don't understand yet, maybe it's there's a blockage or somewhere, something you didn't quite understand yet, but a lot of times it will come later on, if it's important. If it's not important, you don't have to. You know, in the time of the Buddha, there were some monks and nuns. Some of those monks and nuns, they weren't very intelligent, but nevertheless, they could get fully enlightened. And it was amazing. One of those monks was called Chulapantaka, and he was really hard to understand anything. So that his brother, who was a disciple of the Buddha and enlightened, just was trying to teach him. But what really worked, the one thing which really worked for his brother, he gave him a piece of cloth, a white cloth, and told him to keep rubbing the cloth. Very simple thing to do. What's that got to do with nimittas and jhanas and Four Noble Truths and dependent origination, all that sort of stuff? But he kept on rubbing the cloth, and he saw the longer he used it, the more dirty it became, the less attractive, and how it started to fall apart. And he got the message just by that little instruction that, you know, whatever exists in this world, whether it's an emotion in the mind world or whether it's in the physical world, as we use it, it starts to get more and more unattractive. As it gets more and more unattractive, more dirty, more sort of stinky, and eventually it just wears out and falls apart. It's not stable. Even like emotions as well. Joys and happinesses. A good example of that for those people in the world. People love following sport. And I think that's a stupid thing to follow. Because, I mean, how many sides enter competitions? Whether it's a football, or it's cricket, or it's, I don't know, the Australian football. You've got, it was 18 or 16 or 18 clubs, say, are playing in a competition. Only one club can win. 17 clubs have to suffer. And the one who suffers the most, check in psychology, the team who suffers the most is the team who comes second. They're so close, so close. I know, we lost. That's one of the reasons why I could, again, I can believe now, but sometimes in South America they take that so seriously, the soccer, football, that sometimes if the ref, they don't agree with the ref, they shoot him with a gun. Well, it's only a football match, come on. But for them it's not, because it gets so important. You see how people just invest their energies in the world and they have got no alternative, no way of knowing other things to do. But at least here, you know, we have other ideas and things we can do. I just remember one of my friends, he went to a public school in England. Public school means the private schools. Life is very confusing. But anyway, that one of his mates, same year, would always be winning every long distance race that he entered into. He was just really an up and coming star. And they all thought he was going to, you know, be training for the Olympic Games and be a medal winner later on. And then he told me that one day he lost a race. He came actually just not even close to the front of winning. And people were really surprised. He was about 16 or 17 years of age. Why did you lose? You won everything beforehand. And this young man said, I finally realized I didn't have to win. He said, it hurt so much every time, making sure I won. Now I realize I don't have to. And he was much happier. Do you have to be a winner? Winning, being a winner, is a lot of suffering. It's much better to be a loser, like me and like the nuns. We're losers. Admit it. Lost all our money. Lost all. Oh, look at me. I've lost my good figure. I did have a good figure when I was young. So the idea in the world of being a winner, I prefer being a loser. Lose everything. Lose as much as you can. You don't always have to struggle and strive to win and try to be the best, to compete. I never really liked competing. And I'm honestly that when I was a student, you're supposed to do sport. Well, I couldn't really get into it because everybody had to win at all costs. So I finally found a sport where you didn't really have to compete hard. And I was good at it. And I even represented, it's the only sport I represented Cambridge University in the annual match against Oxford University. This is true. Now, it wasn't chess. A couple of you know. I know Veronica knows in the back that that's why she's hiding her head and trying to keep it quiet. What was the sport which I was representing Cambridge at? Oh, yeah, it was tiddlywinks. It's a kid's game, like children play it. We're just doing it for fun, because no one could take that seriously. And we managed to talk the people in Cambridge to letting us. And actually, beforehand, I don't know my age, English humour, there used to be this group of comedians called the Goons. They used to have this goon show. And it was Spike Milligan, Michael Benteen. It was like Monty Python, but before that. Do you remember those goons? Anyone know the goons? So anyway, so what happened? The club in Cambridge, just before I went there, they challenged the goons to a match, tiddlywinks. And it was on a Saturday afternoon, and it was featured on the Saturday afternoon TV show with live updates between how the match was going between Cambridge University and the goons. You've got to hand it to the BBC. The BBC always had a sense of humour, and they didn't mind sort of playing up to that sense of humour every now and again. But anyway, well, I'm really going off on a tangent, aren't I? What am I supposed to be saying? Yes, be a loser. It's much more fun being a loser. Even like, you might tell your kids this. Remember, when you go to school, if you pass the exam, what happens next? You've got another exam coming, you know, 6 months or next year. And you pass that exam, you've got more exams. They get harder as you go along. So you have to keep on going till you fail. So my advice is, fail as soon as you can. Get it all over and done with. And just enjoy your life. Be a loser, not a winner. Or even being a winner in the lottery. Then I already mentioned there's people that always think that monks could tell lottery numbers. If I could tell a lottery number, why don't I just tell our treasury sitting right in front of me now? Make your life easier. And I always like telling the story of this woman in UK who won the lottery. I think £47 million sterling. It's a lot of money, 47 million sterling. No tax, just the, right there, 47 million in your bank. What would you do with 47 million?
SWA.
You say that, but I have to get it in writing in front of a lawyer for it to actually happen. Usually, so, well, I'll give it later on. I'll, you know, it's a slightly difficult. No, but what she did is in the UK, so she bought this big house in the countryside, like a mansion. She always dreamt of living in this beautiful mansion, you know, with nice gardens and parks and nice trees and lakes and streams. Oh, she has a beautiful mansion, about, I don't know, £4 or £5 million. But she sold it within 1 year. At a loss. And then bought a small townhouse in one of the cities. She downsized a lot. And then they asked why. And they sent me the article because it was really inspiring. He said, when I had a big mansion, there were so many rooms and so many sections, the west wing, the north wing, the east wing, the upper wing, the forest wing or whatever. It was such a big house that she never saw the people she loved. Her husband was in one part of the house doing something. Her kids were over in another part of the house. Another kid was somewhere else. There was such a big house, they were split by the size of the house. And she never saw the people she loved. It was destroying her family. And what she did, it was very, very simple, sold the house, bought a small one. And, yeah, it's only a tiny house. But now she could see everybody. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, now there's a lot of wisdom in that. We always want things without realizing what we're wanting is destroying the things which we really love, which are really important. And so, again, I recall growing up in a small council flat. Could never avoid my parents and my brother. They're always around because it's such a small house. But you know, one of the things I remember from those times, which was really important for me, my mother and father would argue. They couldn't hide it. It was too small a house. They couldn't go in a small room and argue. You know, when they sort of raised their voice, you're just going to hear it all over the apartment. As a young kid, you know, I wasn't sort of disappointed in that. This is real life. People do argue. But what I was really impressed with is that after, I don't know, a few hours of arguing, not talking to one another, then they had to make up. They couldn't avoid each other. They couldn't hide. She couldn't go to her room. He couldn't go to his room. There was only one room. And you know what I remember from my youth? Is seeing my mum and dad make up after having an argument. And to me, that was almost worth it, to see them make up and say sorry after arguing with one another. I learnt. There you have an argument. Doesn't mean you can't make up afterwards. And the making up was so much more beautiful than the negativity of seeing the people you love sort of have an argument for a little while. Realize it's the nature of this world. We have disagreements. But the nice thing is we make up in public so everyone can see it. And that was inspiring for me to see. So I don't mind sort of saying things about, oh, those nuns. They're amazing. But then afterwards having the wonderful, if you do, I'll get it wrong. Ah, sorry, I made a mistake. Little things like that, small houses, small places, create a much better emotional source of wisdom. So little by little, we learn so many things. So this is part of the buffet. And once you start to get inspired by the ordinary things of life, like forgiveness, kindness, and you say, oh yeah, you know, that you hurt me, but I will always help you. Doing things like that means that people get inspired, that they can find peace in their life. And with that inspiration, if you're ever part of that inspiration, it's a privilege to be a peacemaker. And if you can do something like that, what it means is it can, oh, what is this wonderful story that was coming up? I knew this because, you know, I was there at the time in Thailand, in the time during the Vietnam War, and when Cambodia and Laos also fell within days of one another. And I was up in that area, you know, in the northeast of Thailand, on my wanderings to Dong Yeo. And I had to always report in to the local police and ask them, is that mountain over there safe? Or are the communists over there? Because in those days there were communist insurgents. These were Thai people who had got fed up with the government in Thailand, who were in the jungles fighting for take over the country. It was an insurrection. And it was violent. And even some of the monks, who were also in another range of mountains, they got tortured and killed. This was real danger, so I always had to check in. But that was in 1979, 80. I was always safe, but it was really quite interesting when the soldiers would come with the M16s, about three or four of them on patrol. But the nice thing about it was they'd always put the guns next to a tree and then take off their shoes, come and bow, and then just ask for a blessing. They would never take the guns into the vicinity of a monk. They'd always keep them a few meters away. And so you get to know exactly what was going on there by talking to all those soldiers. But then what happened? Now, after I finished my Tudong time, a wandering time in that area, that eventually the problem in that part of the country just disappeared. It was all healed. And I remember this, the solution to the problem. It was a very nice Buddhist solution, that it was always non-violence. The soldiers, they knew where those enemy camps were. They said they could have gone in there with the helicopter gunships and stuff which they had from the Americans, shot them all up, bombed them. They never did that. They said, for every of those insurgents we kill, we create two or three more. Their family and friends will get a reason to fight even harder against us. It was non-violence. And number two was amnesty. Anytime any one of those insurgents wanted to give themselves up, they just gave up their weapons. They weren't interrogated or asked any questions. Sent back to their universities or their villages. Everything forgiven. And I know that was true. And the last thing was, you know, why are they insurgents anyway? And you have to hand it, you know, to the previous king of Thailand, who spent a lot of time and money making sure that part of Thailand had a bit more development. Simple things like sealed roads, simple things like dams up in the mountains to have enough water for them to have like 2 crops a year, and also little medical clinics inside every village. And he was mostly responsible for that. And I remember one of the soldiers telling me once, he said, when the insurgents go down into the village to get some rice, you know, we all know who they are. We don't sort of interrogate them or shoot them or say anything to them. He said, I just show them the new radio I've just bought with my wages. Just show them just how the village is actually becoming more prosperous, how the place is becoming more kind to everybody. And they said, one by one, those insurgents gave themselves up. Not through fighting. They were given jobs in their village or town, or carried on their university training. And he said, it's a beautiful way of dealing with the problem, but I always remember the best part, which I read in a newspaper, and I checked this out, because I gave this talk once over in Canberra, where I was visiting. Canberra, Sydney. Yeah, I think it was in Canberra. And then the ambassador at the time, a male ambassador, after I told the talk, he put his hand up and said, I want to confirm to the audience what you said is exactly right. There's something else I want to tell you as well. Because what had happened, once all those insurgents had given themselves up with no violence, it came the time when the leaders of that insurgency, the ringleaders, there's about 3 of them, gave themselves up. And when they gave themselves up, you couldn't just have just forgiveness, you know, go back to university and carry on working. It was much more delicate than that. So what they did with the 3 insurgent leaders of the group, which was, really could have very easily taken over the country, they gave them these really good jobs in the government service, realizing that these were committed to looking after the country, looking after the people, or whatever you wish to say. And they had lots of skills. Why put them up against a wall and shoot them? Why put them in jail? Let's make use of these insurgents for the country. And the reason I say that, because that ambassador, when he put his hand up, he said, actually, 2 of those insurgents are now ministers in the government of Thailand. They've become politicians, and they were working for the country instead of against it. So sometimes I kind of get inspired by things like that. There are other ways. And when you can find that other way and do it, wow, it's amazing what we can do. Inspire people. That inside of us, we all have this beautiful wanting to do something to help. And one of the last little stories, there was one of these prisoners. The prisoner I challenged up in Carnet, I challenged him to do something kind and good for the person you hated most in the prison. And of course I was a prison officer, and eventually got the prison officer to actually recognize him and say something kind, like a thank you to a prisoner who was unknown before. That same prisoner, his name was Nick, I still remember him. He grabbed me one time while I arrived to give the meditation class and said, before we start, can you please come over here? And he took me to the schoolhouse, and there was a big notice board on the school in the schoolhouse. And on that notice board were all these cards made by school children in primary school. Dear Nick, thank you for visiting us. I hope you get out soon. When you get out, please come and visit us. Don't forget us. We love you. I understand you. Thank you so much. By all these little Mary and Paul and whatever. And he was weeping. Not crying, it's not the right word. Weeping. Tears were just pouring down from him. So what happened? And he said that was where he told me that the local primary school in Jarrahdale, I can say it now, it's many years ago, the principal there of the primary school had been told by the education department in town, we need to do something to protect our kids from drugs. So here's a little amount of money, you can get a psychologist in or some sort of program in. And this principal in Jarrahdale Primary School did much, much better than that. Who are the experts? Who knows about drugs more than anybody and what it does to you? So they got two of the prisoners from Carnet. How she managed to wangle this, I really don't know. Because if anybody had found out, if the papers, newspapers had found out, there'd be a big scandal. Prisoners coming to teach our children about drugs. So because of that, they kept it quiet for many years and asked me to keep it quiet too, which I did. But it's a story which should have been told, because two of the prisoners went to that primary school, spent the whole afternoon, the whole day, I don't know, teaching all the classes of what drugs are really like. Not what politicians say, not what psychologists or doctors say, but people who have been there, tasted it, know deeply about what goes on and how it wrecks your life. And they told all these stories, and they really connected full on with these kids in primary school. You can see that with all the little cards the teachers had their kids make for these two prisoners. And that's one of the reasons why that Nick, when he showed me these cards, he was just couldn't help himself, weeping and weeping, weeping. He'd done something good to try and stop other people going the path he'd gone down. It's a beautiful act of kindness, a beautiful giving. And of course later on, I remember just one of the most common places which I used to go to in those days, the airport. Sitting down, I think I was waiting for someone to arrive at Perth Airport. And then somebody touched me on the shoulders. I turned around, it was Nick, in a really nice suit. He said, I'm still meditating, Ajahn Brahm, I just want to let you know I'm still meditating every day. And he's obviously doing well in his life. He had the opportunity to heal himself and to change his life and to make something of himself. And that was one of the most important parts of just innovating, doing something which is different. And I think all you can understand why you get a prisoner, a really nice one, he just made some stupid mistakes, just trying to get rich quick, and he got caught. And how that could change his whole life. It's a beautiful little story. And sometimes, if I get tired, I remember those stories. In a small part, I was involved in it. And how wonderful that was, and how that gives you lots of energy. Chag Anusati, Sir Anusati, all these Anusati means like reflections. And how that gives you so much joy and happiness that when you start to meditate, you sit down, whoa, there's a big boost. You know, when you start and you get some wonderful meditations that way. Learning how to develop happiness, the joy, the good type of happiness. And that happiness and joy, that inspiration, that just takes you off into really deep meditation. Of course, if you hear a good talk, like I used to hear all these, not just boring talks from Ajahn Chah, some really good talks from Ajahn Chah. And when he hit the spot, wow, he could really hit the spot. And then afterwards, you couldn't help yourself. And just blissing out. That's a beautiful thing to do. And some of my experiences, it's almost 9 o'clock now, so I won't tell them now. But tomorrow morning, can you please ask me to the old story of the sauna and the reading one's mind. That's tomorrow morning. Many of you have heard it before, it's one of the deepest stories, but it's just, whoa. How it came about, what happened was beautiful. Or should I do it now? I don't need to read your mind, I can say, okay, here we go. So this was last year before I came to Australia. It's great you could have these experiences and share them with everybody. Ajahn Chah was getting sick, and we can build saunas in monasteries because those saunas were mentioned in the Vinaya. In the time of the Buddha, they had saunas in India. They did not come from Sweden. India got there first. And anyway, so we built a sauna for Ajahn Chah, and he would come every week. It was pretty selfish, I must admit, because we knew that he would come every week to give us a talk. And he'd give the talk first, and he'd have his sauna. And of course, many, many talks, some are really on the spot, and some are just, you've got to wait, when is he going to finish? But this was one of those very sweet ones, really inspired. And then he went off to his sauna. Other monks were looking after him. And I thought, I can't resist. I just went in the back of the hall, just sitting on the bare concrete, and just meditating for 2 hours, blissing out. Really beautiful meditation. And then after a while, when you come out, it was about 2 hours, you don't know at the time, when you come out afterwards, there's just so much happiness, so much joy, so much peace. And then so I thought, well, I should go and find my teacher, see if I can pay some sort of gratitude to him by maybe helping him in the sauna still. So I walked over by myself, all the other monks, I don't know where they'd gone, they were probably helping out in the sauna or having a sauna themselves. Because when I was going towards the sauna, I saw Ajahn Chah coming in the opposite direction, I think with his driver. And there's no way I could avoid him. I just go past him, just go off the path a little bit, so he could get by me. But he didn't stop. He stopped, and he looked at me. And remember, I just had a really nice meditation. When you've got a very good meditation, your mind is so pure. And so that's when he read my mind. And I don't mind saying that, because he really did. You could feel him inside you. Hard for me to say that, but that's true. And I often say this was the one time I was very happy, very content to have him go inside and have a look around. I had nothing to hide at all. In fact, I was quite proud of my mind like that. It looked really, really nice and pure and happy. So have a look. Would you be happy if, say, Leha just checked out your room right now to make sure it was all tidy and everything was in its right place?
Yes.
You would? Okay, Leha, do you want to go? But you know what I mean, sometimes you've got some junk in the room. They give me 5 minutes to clean it up, first of all. But anyway, so my mind was so clean. So Ajahn Chah had a look. I know you could feel it, it's weird, but I'm just being honest with you. And then he looked at me. Seriously. So not angrily, but like someone who's really grabbing you and not letting you go anywhere before he asked his question. And that's when he said to me, Brahma Wangsa, because I wasn't Ajahn then, not compared to Ajahn Chah. Brahma Wangsa, that's the full name. Brahma Wangsa. Why? And that's what he said, just the question, why? And my answer was, I was very peaceful, didn't think, weren't trying to impress anybody. My answer was, I don't know. I was really dumb. That's what made him really laugh a lot of the time, because he knew I went to this big university like Cambridge. He couldn't realize, he couldn't imagine just how dumb people who went to big universities are. I'll put my hand up, I was. I knew about physics, but didn't know nothing about life. Why? I don't know. And of course, instead of being really fed up with his disciple, he just laughed and laughed and laughed. And when he stopped laughing, he screwed up his face again. Brahma Wangsa, I'll tell you the answer. When he said something like that, I thought, wow, this is really interesting. He's going to be telling me the answer to the question, why? Personally, from a great monk, and I had an open mind, really open mind. This is going to be great. Why? I'll tell you the answer. And what he said afterwards was so brilliant, so deep. My, me, or I. There's nothing, he said. There's nothing. Profound. That was very easy to understand, but so deep. He looked at me again with so much care and compassion. Do you understand? And I said, yes.
Yeah.
He said, no, you don't. And then he went away. From being so high, I was just right down with the beetles and the dust on the floor. But it's a beautiful little experience. And it's so simple that it's easy to explain 100% accurately. Why? There's nothing. My mirror. So free. So you may not understand now, but you will do. You can't avoid it. Once Ajahn Chah gets inside your head, you can't kick him out. So anyway, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good, okay.